Welcome to Fears, Phobias, and Feelings, Classical Conditioning. In this podcast, we're going to discuss what makes someone successful and also how to possibly remove roadblocks. Our investigation is really going to look at reflexes and emotions because that's the stuff of classical conditioning. As I mentioned in previous podcasts, I think that it's really important to, add the mind back into the equation, which behaviorists did not do. True behavioral theory in its most pure form is going to leave the mind out of the equation. Now is as good a time as any to say that I have worked on theory development myself for literally decades. Really going on almost half a century, which is pretty much my whole life. From the time I was really little, I was always observing the environment around me and trying to put the pieces together to see how it all fit. So of course, when I started studying psychology theory, I did the same thing. I started to put everything together rather than just seeing things as separate or seeing one theory as being the only theory there is or the most superior theory. Personally, I think Pavlov's work gives us a very strong foundation for the nature-nurture link that is found in all of us. But clearly, even Pavlovian conditioning is not the entire answer as to how a human being grows, develops, and becomes who they are. The theory of classical conditioning gives us a glimpse into a portion of the human experience. And when you take a look, I think you'll see that oftentimes theories fit together in a way that just is absolutely amazing and fills in the blanks for us in certain areas. By now, if you've done your homework, you will have had experience in working with Pavlovian conditioning as well as John B. Watson's form and format for classical conditioning. I'm going to tell you a little story at this point about one of my previous students, and I want you to try to look for elements in this story of conditioning. Classical conditioning, and you can use either Pavlov's format with pure reflex, or you can look at Watson's with the emotional experience being seen as the response. Okay, so many years ago, I was working with a hopeful vocal artist as a child. This child wanted to be a big star, and actually she did make her dreams come true with a number of absolutely excellent opportunities. For example, she landed a lead role on Broadway. She performed on national television. She sang the national anthem at professional sporting event, and more. So clearly, what we did in her early years set her up for some great success. Would you believe that early on, at the very start of her career, she had stage fright? This little girl was approximately 6.5 years old or so at the time of this story. I had been working with her for about a year at that point. With her first audition ever, she was accepted to perform at a big community event called the Chasco Fiesta. In preparation for this event, I asked her mother to bring her to the park where she was going to be performing. Can you figure out why I did this? Why did I bring her to the park? I had this little girl stand on the very stage that she was going to be performing on, and then I created this emotional picture for her. I got down to her level and I said, "There's going to be a sea of people out there. Bunch of people. Can you see that lawn? It's going to be filled with people. And you're going to sing for all of them." What I was doing, in case you haven't figured it out yet, was setting her up for an emotional experience on the stage right at that point. Now, was I being cruel? I absolutely was not being cruel. I knew that when this little girl got up onto the stage, and there was actually a sea of people there, if she wasn't prepared for that experience, that the emotional experience would be overwhelming for her, and that fear would eventually be linked to performing on stage because of this experience. So I wanted her to experience that potential fear when it was safe to do so, when there was actually really nobody in the audience at that point, when we were alone there with some people on the lawn playing and doing their thing, but really when we were alone, essentially without other performers and without the stage set up for the performance itself. So after telling this poor little girl that there was going to be a sea of people out in the audience, I looked at her and I said, "Are you excited?" And obviously you could tell she was going to have some fear. So she looked at me and she's like, "Mm-hmm." I said, "Oh, what's the matter? Are you nervous?" And she said, "Yeah." And I said, "Oh, why?" I said, is it because there's going to be a sea of people out there?" And she kind of shook her head sheepishly and said, "Yeah, I think so." And at that point, I took her away from the stage and I said, "Let's go have a conference." I had conferences with my students at times when we needed to address certain things. But really what I was doing was moving her away from that stimulus, the stimulus of the stage that was linked to this fear experience, so that I could change the potential for the emotional experience when she returned to that stage. At the side of the stage, I sat with this child and we talked about the experience, and we talked about how she was going to have to do the song a bunch of times if she sang for people in smaller groups, even though that might feel more comfortable to her, how many times would she have to perform it, etc. So I walked her through a series of explanation that was linked to emotion. And this detail I'm not going to give to you in the podcast, but this is what I did. And then I returned this child to the stage, the initial potential trigger for fear. Because of the discussion we had and the linkage that I created mentally for this child to impact and kind of even interrupt and replace the initial fear potential, the child was ready to perform. So once again, I created the image for her. I said, "Do you see the sea of people out there?" And I built into the discussion at that point this excitement about creating an experience for the audience, etc., that really, really got to this child. She connected with what I was saying. She became excited. And now the stage itself became present as a conditioned stimulus for excitement, for higher energy, for competence. As you can probably imagine, on the day of the actual performance, that child did not experience stage fright. When it was her turn to perform, she went out there, she knocked them dead. She wowed the audience so much that she ended up being featured in the newspaper article for the event at about 6.5 years old. When you understand these theories in great detail, when you understand how they fit into the big picture of the real world and the human being as a whole, you have so much use potential to help yourself and to help others. I've created a system that I use with great effect. The workbooks that I'm offering at this point are designed to help you see how I see the human experience of development and even, I guess you could say, like I've said before, programming. We've all had experiences where we have been programmed, for lack of better terminology. As we were growing up, we were exposed to environments that were really out of our control. Even as adults, we're exposed to environments regularly that we don't control. Our exposures shape us. They shape us every single day. When you look at classical conditioning theory, you can see that very, very clearly. So choose your environments and choose your exposures well, my friends. Choose them well. And let's move on next to taking a look at the theory of operant conditioning by B.F. Skinner.